Ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to introduce Garner Ted Armstrong of Ambassador College with The World Tomorrow. In this series of programs, we will tell you something of the problems of the world today, how they will affect you, and their solution in The World Tomorrow. Ladies and gentlemen, Garner Ted Armstrong.
Never before in history has there been anything like it. A nation, one of the biggest nations on the face of the earth, and one of the most powerful, the United States of America, having successfully alienated our most prized national resource, our youth. Never before has there been anything in any society in all of history quite like this. A subculture, teenage it's called, almost totally alienated from the goals, the values, the mores, the laws, the standards, the principles, the institutions of the adult generation. Education has been called that process by which the adult generation seeks to instill its values, its social conduct, its standards, its laws, its language, its religion, into the minds of its youth. Somewhere, somehow along the way, the young people in the United States, and to a large degree in many other countries of the Western world, and certainly in Canada, are just not having it anymore. The old cherished dog-eared traditions of society, they are rejecting. Rejecting wholesale. Why? How did it get started? And are some of these old established traditions worth rejecting? I'll tell you, you bet they are. And the young people are so ripe for someone to tell them the truth instead of lying to them. I have asked time and again why, if young people, as if with one voice, have rejected the established mores and traditions of society, have so many tens of thousands of them in what is called the Jesus movement, turned right around and accepted, embraced with open arms, the establishment Jesus. It goes deeper than that, though. Child crimes, it became to be known, juvenile delinquency, the problem of the 50s and on into the 60s, and then the hard drug scene that became inescapably noticed continually in the 60s and on in now into the early 70s, for the United States of America, with a new drug subculture reaching all the way, sometimes into junior high and into the grade school, down into the sixth grade of our educational system, cries out for understanding and for solution. The chances are that about every third or fourth home into which this program comes has a youngster which has sampled drugs. The chances are very high that you are sitting right beside in the same room with youngsters that you think are just about as common and average and everyday as anybody else. And if they have not been offered drugs, I'll be shocked. And if they have not sampled them, mildly surprised. It's quite a common thing these days. Why? How did it get started? How did an entire generation succeed in so alienating its youth that in the 50s we began to see the age of 18, then 17, now 16, cropping up as one of the most highly representative ages for police arrests in the United States of America? Why dropouts? Why so many completely disillusioned with the school systems, leaving the schools, taking to the roads with their packs and their camping equipment, such as it is, their rolled-up sleeping bags and their big boots, and their girl with the long hair and the boy with the beard and the long hair and the open-toed sandals and maybe the guitar and the sign where he's going. Tens of thousands of them, not just a scattered few here and there, but increasingly a whole generation dropping out of society, which ought to be dropped out from really by everybody, turning on with drugs, seeking in no particular direction the answers to the big problems that nag at them and not knowing where to look and where to go. What is the cause? Well, it's like asking, here you see a burning wreck. Remember when Ralph Nader took on General Motors? And wasn't it a Corvette? Was that it? It was one of the, General Motors automobile. It was a little sports car made by the Chevrolet company. Now, maybe that's old hat today to many people, but he took on this entire giant corporation. He began to reason, along with those who with him had investigated the situation. You may remember the famous book. And of course, Ralph Nader's name is known now pretty much worldwide. He thought that when an automobile leaks like a sieve, when it rains, when it has about 25 easily discernible factory defects upon delivery, when its suspension system is so dangerous that at high speeds it might even leave the road, when automobiles were being made that would literally, quite literally, break right in two, that something must be wrong. Effect. An automobile about to break into, or one that leaves the road at high speed. Cars. is the factory over there. The smokestacks are smoking, the automobiles are moving along the assembly line, and people are working away. Somewhere in design factor, somewhere in the suspension system, somewhere in the assembly line. And the construction of this vehicle was the cause for that effect. Why did the skyjacker parachute out of the airplane? Then why did several others begin doing it all over the world? Well, because the very first successful, if it was, they never found him, I don't believe, to this day, the very first successful skyjacker with a sack full of money and a parachute was so sensationalized in worldwide press, many others began to try it. Right after the motion picture, which I thought personally was one of the biggest flops I'd ever seen. And I was amazed. You know, leaders clear up to the highest echelon in government were really acclaiming that movie called Skyjacked. The language that was used by the controllers, by the pilots, what happened in that airplane, and that was so funny, a guy came crawling out from underneath the 707 in the compartment there with his frost all over his beard. That was one of the funniest things I ever heard in my life. Because, you know, they put your dogs and cats down in there in that baggage compartment. They had been stuck up there, presumably, in the nose wheel well or somewhere. But everything that went on in that movie was really hilarious to me because I spent hundreds and hundreds of hours flying a modern jet airplane, and I had talked about it dozens of hours to air traffic controllers. I'd shot hundreds of ILS and every other type of instrument approach. And to see this big 707, is a Corvair, was the automobile? Thank you. Somebody just showed me notes. A Corvair, not a Corvette. There's a difference there somewhere. But to see this big 707 jet on this blinding rainstorm, they're coming into the airport up in Alaska in this sensationalized motion picture about Skyjack. There's a little bonanza there, a little single-engine airplane. They're going along at the same approach speed. And the guy on the GCA approach, which is a radar approach, he's a buddy of the pilot. He says, bring it right in there, George. Come on, hello, baby. You know, the language that was used was really something else again. I don't know. At least you would think they could have gotten an AOPA member that owned a 172 or something to give them some advice about the real jargon, the real language that goes on in a modern airplane cockpit. Or maybe they thought that the real language would be uninteresting to the average public and they ought to just beef it up a little bit. But anyhow, after that sensationalized motion picture, the incident of people demanding millions, increasingly larger sums of money, and parachutes, and first, you know, the one guy had the man stripped down to, wasn't it, what, a pair of shorts or a swimming suit or something, and then next, they made the poor FBI man come walking toward the airplane, start staring naked, I don't know, but each time the skyjacking was sensationalized, some nut comes along and tries to improve upon it. We wonder, is there any cause and effect? Now, police agencies know that there is a direct relationship between this kind of sensationalized publicity and some nut somewhere deciding to try it for himself. But now, what about a sex crime? They discover someone has brutally murdered a little girl. This has happened. In his automobile, they discover a whole stack of hardcore pornography, and his apartment has a lot of hardcore pornography in it. Is there any cause and effect relationship here? I believe there is. Police departments believe there is. Police chiefs, men who work with drug addiction and with sex crimes and the hardcore type of crimes against a person, muggings, rapes, murders, and the like, will tell you from their years of experience, 15, 20, 30 years of experience sometimes, that they see a direct relationship between the influences that shape this person's life, the pastimes, his reading material, what he goes through for entertainment that shapes his desires and his motivations, that these then break out in some aberrant act and somebody gets killed. They see a direct cause and effect relationship. So then somebody sits around and says, now we really have no evidence to demonstrate that a sex criminal may have been motivated to commit such crimes by hardcore pornography. People are singing this whining song today. They're trying to point out some of the Scandinavian countries, but they claim that a person's emotions are allowed to be released by going to watch hardcore pornography, triple X-rated motion pictures and the like, and that he is less likely to commit a sex crime. And I ask, who do they think they're kidding? Since when does that kind of prurient viewing, that kind of hardcore eroticism, relieve anybody's tensions. Somebody is trying to divorce himself from reality and claim immunity from the human race. If he comes up with that kind of a story and you hear it, he doesn't know what he's talking about. The police departments of our country can tell you there is a direct relationship, a cause and effect relationship between sex crimes and our fantastic obsession with sex in every form, in motion pictures, sex and violence, in novels, sex and violence, in hardcore, dirty, filthy pornography, sex along with violence. And they say there's a direct cause and effect relationship. Maybe some of us don't like to believe it. Well, let me tell you, just as much as you can trace an automobile and its suspension system to the design factor in the factory, so can you trace the turned-off kids on our highways and byways who want no part of society back to the factory from which they came. Why should cause and effect be such an enormous problem, such a big question to people? Time and again, I hear some do-gooder type of sensationalized expose about the kids. Everybody's going to analyze why the young people are turned off, why they're turning on the drugs, dropping out from society. They begin to talk about all these unacceptable things in society. Society didn't breed those children. Society did not rear them. Society didn't train them. Society did not have to influence them. If it was allowed to, it's because somebody else was guilty somewhere along the line. Every one of those young people somewhere has parents. In many cases, they may not even know who they are. But let me tell you, that the ones that get in trouble with the law, as they get busted or hassled by the police, maybe on a drug rap or something else, because when you get down to the point of feeding about a $35, $40, $75 per day drug habit, you got to steal a lot of television sets to keep going when you're a kid with no job. And tens of thousands of them are working every angle you can begin to imagine. From stealing from their own parents to practically everybody else, yes, and even each other, down to the hippie trick of a girl walking into the bar, and then when the fellow stumbles out half drunk thinking she's going to let him take her home, they go into the parking lot, and wham, he gets hit over the head. Maybe the car as well as the wallet disappears. There are fences around. It's a whole drug subculture, and don't think for one instant that much, practically all, really a tremendous percentage, our teenage crime is not traceable directly back to the drug scene, because it is, again, cause and effect. But what turned them on to drugs in the first place? Because they can come from so-called good homes as well as bad homes. Famous comedian Alan King and his son had the same answer you can hear practically anywhere. Alan was talking about his job, his life, how busy it is, how he's on the road all the time, and he would come home exhausted, and he'd had a rough day, and just so tired, turn on television. He was very free and open and talking about it. He sort of knew what was happening. He hated to come back after several days or even a week or two absence, and then the first thing he does is discipline the kid. So both of them were interviewed, big newspaper, almost a full page, pictures and so on, because the boy finally, about 17, I think, ended up on hard drugs. He thought maybe send him over to the kibbutz in Israel. That would give him some responsibility. Everybody wants to send their child to Israel. Why? Because, as I showed on a series of programs we did on Israel, everyone seems to idealize the Israeli state and believe that this is a nation that really has everything going, everything all put together. It's the greatest place in the world to be. Well, the problems are inside of us, and if we take our problems inside of us to an idealistic state, if we think it is, which it really is not, they have the same problems we do. They are the microcosm of the problems of the United States. But if we think that's the place to get the problem solved, we're missing the bet. Well, Alan King realizes it now. They both said the same thing. The father said that he was working hard, he was tired, it was TV, and then to bed, up in the morning and back to the job. The son said he was crying out inside himself for love, for recognition, for appreciation, for his father to spend some time with him, for some communication between them. And he had to go get it somewhere, as do all the young people. And they're going to get, in the rap sessions, the pop parties, the wild, exciting, hilarious times, they're going to get in the arms and in the company of their peer group, the same age group, what they so inside themselves earnestly desire, really, and need from their parents. They will find it. They will find understanding for the half-thought-out, unrealized dreams of youth. they will find somewhere commiseration with their uptight attitudes, or their upsets about the way things are going, about the way Dad is, and the way Mom is, and the way somebody else is. They're going to find some way to communicate in a kind of a teenage subculture form of language that has evolved in our era and our age. They're going to find someone who will listen to them, who will take the time, and where are they going to find people who will do that? But other kids just like themselves who have the same hang-ups, the same desire for communication, they want, really inside themselves, hundreds, thousands have said this as they've been interviewed, it's the same tired story over and over again. They want inside themselves for Dad to really lay it on the line, to say, look, let's do this and that and the other thing, here are the rules, we're going to live by them, and then to be a companion and a friend as well as a father, as well as a rules maker, as well as a breadwinner and the head of the household. They really want these things deep down inside themselves, a father of whom they can be proud. Lacking this, they're going to find some outlet, some method by which they can experience what it is they so desire. So the son said that he was crying out for recognition. He found it in a drug-oriented culture. It began with soft drugs and parties. He began stealing from his own father. Later on, he even turned other youngsters on to drugs, including his own younger brother. The trip to Israel didn't pay off because he took the drugs along with him. And then he got in jail two different times and finally ended up being deported. Finally, he went to one of these groups, and there are many, and there are some in your city, that are organized to help youngsters find their way off the drug scene and back into reality. And we have done so many specials on it, on this program, where we have interviewed young people, and I intend to keep doing that and keep hitting that subject time and again because it is with us. It's a big and an important phenomenon of our time, a direct contributor to much, almost all, of teenage crime. And the drug scene is responsible, I imagine, for wrecking more lives, more minds, and more bodies than the Vietnam War by far. It really is. We just don't see very many people out crusading like that against drugs, out taking to the streets and wild big jamborees and explosive confrontations. But, you know, we ought to be consistent in the things that we are against. There are 55,000 Americans dying in automobile accidents every single year, a lot of that relating directly to improper training, improper driver's training, improper manufacture of automobiles, too much speed, drugs, perhaps other kinds of repressants or stimulants, including certainly alcohol, that takes 55,000 and more American lives every year, but not very much is said about this. So the product is known by the factory. And in the case of Alan King and his son, the story was the same tiresome repetition of so many tens of thousands of other American homes. Here was a so-called good home, a big mansion now that Alan King is able to live in. Well, he's been successful. He got to the top in his profession. And his kid had everything. He wasn't wanting for anything. He wasn't coming from a ghetto family like Alan himself did. He didn't have to work his way up. His father gave him everything he wanted. Why, then, people ask, this kid came from a good home? Well, I'll show you. What is our evaluation? How do we say one home is a good home and another home is a bad home? And that the bad kids come from bad homes and the good kids come from good homes. Let's not kid ourselves. It is perhaps the other way around, but I'll give you a new definition in a moment of just what is a really good home. The facts are that youngsters who get, as we say, in trouble, and I mean when I say in trouble with the law, and in trouble because so many of them are marrying by accident and because of premarital pregnancies as well as venereal disease and the hard drug scene, the many ways in which you can get in trouble, whether you are apprehended by a law enforcement body or not, you can get in trouble by breaking up and ruining your own health, your own mind, your own hopes and dreams for the future. So when I say trouble, I mean everything that embodies trouble that a teenager can get into at that age. Why, then, do young people get into trouble who come from so-called good homes? Well, what do we mean, good home? Is a good home a middle-income home? A home with two cars in the driveway or the garage and all of the electrical appliances, maybe a swimming pool, a home where Dad has a good solid job and Mom maybe works outside too? Take Canada, a small nation in comparative size to population and the second largest in the entirety of the world in land area. In Canada, about 52% of the female workforce are married. Most of them mothers. Over half, then, of all working women have somewhere a home. What happens in that home? while the mother is out getting extra income. Extra income for what? Well, supplementary income. Perhaps for her clothing. Perhaps for some electronic devices she wants. Maybe for a color television set instead of a black and white. Maybe for a boat or a sports car the family's been thinking about. Or next year's vacation. Maybe to put a kid through college. Maybe some very exemplary ideas. Helping to pay for the home, building a new wing on it. Maybe putting a carport or a garage in. Or a cellar before next winter. Who knows? There are all kinds of reasons why women work. But working mothers, disrupted homes, you can see them one neat home after another in America and Canada. Middle-income homes, $10,000, $18,000 a year. This might be the salary earned by both the working father and the mother. So people would say when a son or a daughter is apprehended in some grisly crime or ends up in some school trying to kick the hard drug route, I can't understand it. Why, these kids came from a good home. They always had everything. And so here's the same tiresome old story. In Brooklyn not long ago, a man and his wife sat and sobbed in a police station when they had discovered their son Jack Koslow, or Koslow, it might have been pronounced K-O-S-L-O-W. This is true. This is a fact. This was back a few years, but it really happened. There was a teenage thrill-kill gang in Brooklyn. And this boy had become the brains of that gang. They had brutally slashed and murdered many people. An absolute Killers Incorporated. And he was exactly 18. They sobbed in the police station. She said, "What did I do wrong?" She said, "We gave him everything." "Who could understand that Jack was anything but a good boy?" the husband said bitterly. He was clutching a newspaper in his fist to describe one of the most bloody, grisly murders, thrill kills, that you could imagine in your life, and they were sitting there shaking their heads and saying, "I can't understand it. Jack was always such a good boy. We always gave him everything. We never denied him anything." She said, "I look back over these 18 years since they brought him down in the hospital, a 9-pound boy, and I don't know why. I'd give my life," she said, "if somebody would tell me why." Last time I was talking about 12 rules for rearing a delinquent child. This compiled is a result of the experience of police officers over a vast period of time dealing with thousands of young people. And it says, quote, "The first rule for rearing a delinquent child is this. Begin with infancy to give the child everything he wants." That's the first rule. Well, people shake their heads and they say, "I can't understand it." And they begin to equate material things with what is really needed. Love, affection, understanding, discipline, leadership, and the right example. Because a child is going to learn far better by the parent's example than by all the pretty speeches and the wonderful flowery sayings and the quaint old proverbs and all the wives' tales and father's little colloquialisms all put together. They're going to reject every single time, because we just automatically do this business of "don't do as I do, do as I say do." The parent who comes staggering in from a wild bash on a weekend that tries to box his kid's ears for getting in too late is just not going to hack it. He's never going to get the job done. You can't beat that factory. I know. I've been in education for many, many years, and I've dealt with young people for many, many years. I've been a superintendent over grade and high schools for many, many years, and I have dealt with them all the way. I am now closely associated with young people in college whom I saw come in as little toddlers in the first grade. And I have known them all their lives, and I have seen the difference between a right kind of education and the wrong kind of education. And I know that as teachers, any educational system, no matter how firmly founded on a spiritual and a scriptural footing, which these schools I talk about are, they acknowledge God, they acknowledge Jesus Christ of Nazareth, they acknowledge the laws of God and the right child-rearing methods. But I know time and time again of case after case where we were ineffective, because the child came to school too late, and where even if the child did come to school, the school could not, by every conceivable influence, undo what that parent is able to do at home. You can't whip the factory. When you buy a car, you can't take a screwdriver and a pair of pliers and fix up 25 discernible defects in your own garage. If that factory's already put together a pretty bad design, you're not going to be able to straighten it out with a few hand tools at home any more than parents can expect the police departments of society, the judges of society, and the teachers in the school systems to take these kids of theirs that they have produced, that they have influenced, that they have warped and twisted at home, and magically create a model citizen out of this product that they, the parents, have produced. Well, there's a great deal more to it, a tremendous subject. It has to do with the laws on child rearing that you read of in your own Bible. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.